It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gaffin. When you think of art exhibitions and crafts classes, you might think of a site somewhere around the city of Pittsburgh, but tucked into the Laurel Highlands, not far from Ohio Pile and Falling Water, is the Touchstone Center for Crafts, which offers retreat-style experiences for artists and other classes as well. Lindsay Gates is the executive director of Touchstone. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you.
I'm sure many of our listeners at one time or another have taken craft classes, but you offer, among your variety of classes, immersive workshops. What does that mean?
So we are one of only a handful of craft schools like us in the country that bring in individuals to take classes from 1 to 5 days where they are actually in a retreat-style space. They're immersed among our campus for the entire duration that they're there. They're staying in our housing, they're eating in our dining hall, and they are in the studio pretty much 24/7, just studying with a master in whatever craft they are studying and getting a completely unique experience where they're among there can be up to 6 other workshops going at the same time. So It's not just, say, the metalsmiths that they're studying with, but they're also with the glass artists and the blacksmiths and the ceramic artists. And it really creates a dynamic community where people learn from each other and share ideas and kind of cross-pollinate all of these different media.
Why is it so rare, a center such as this, and having these immersive experiences?
Well, it's a real commitment. It's a commitment for the organization to have really top-notch facilities and be able to and willing to bring in artists from all over the country. And also, it's a real commitment to the individual to come and stay for an extended duration. But I would say that people who do take advantage of that and come for these experiences always come back because it's something that is so unique and treasured.
So who are these people? Are they beginning a career, in mid-career, somebody who wants to just always keep brightening and enhancing their skills? What?
All of the above. For a really long time, we catered to more mid-career artists and emerging artists. We have extended that to catering to professional artists who want to learn a new skill or enhance an existing one. And we've also begun to create programming that is perfect for the novice who maybe is intimidated by the idea of staying for an extended period of time at a facility where you're going to go in depth into one of these media, but would love to come for 2 hours and dip their toe in, see what the experience is like, and then think about going on further. So you really don't have to have any skill at all to attend most of our workshops. And it's obvious in our catalog which workshops are geared to what level of student.
What's the range of classes from what to what medium?
Wow. Well, our main focus is blacksmithing, ceramics, glass. We bring in other special topics, metalsmithing. We have encaustic, painting, drawing, a little bit of everything.
Blacksmithing, is there much of a demand for that?
There is an incredible demand.
Why?
Certainly shows like Forged by Fire help fuel that. But Touchstone was really, and still is, has one of the best teaching studios in the country to learn blacksmithing. It was conceived of and built by people who had a focus on wanting to make sure that the skills of blacksmithing lived on. And so it was built for exactly what it's used for. A lot of studios are adapted for teaching. This was actually built so that we can accommodate up to 24 students at a time.
Touchstone was founded in 1972. Realizing you've only been there for about a year, but understanding the history, how would you say the mission has evolved?
I think we've stayed pretty true to our mission, although I would say that originally it was focused more on traditional crafts, and that has since really expanded to encompass all craft techniques, pushing them into the next century.
Are there some new crafts emerging crafts that you're dabbling in, you're exploring as a possibility, a possible addition?
Well, I would say that a lot of the techniques that are being taught in the studios that we already focus on mm-hmm. are really what is evolving and changing. So we had a workshop on casting concrete jewelry. Yeah. So techniques like that that are really updating the original focus of the studio.
It's obviously a more rural setting. Does that add to the creativity of the artists? Does the relative seclusion help as well?
Absolutely. We have 150 beautiful wooded acres. We are nestled among that. We have campfires every night. We have an outdoor brick oven where we cook pizza. It's really an incredible experience to be immersed in nature and have that kind of break from the everyday. In fact, this coming season in 2020, we're partnering with some of the researchers from Powder Mill Nature Reserve to be on site for one full week of workshops where everything that we're teaching that week will be based on learning about the nature on our campus and then using that as inspiration or as materials for what they're doing in their studios.
How do you feel Touchstone adds to the community? How does it contribute to the fabric of the community?
We're such an amazing cultural resource for the area. We are really trying to partner with other organizations so that people realize what we can offer as a resource, whether it's facility rental opportunities or whether we can take an artist and help to fulfill a need in their community or their schools. We have artists going into three different schools for after-school programs. We also worked with Story Square in Uniontown last year to create four murals with the community members. So we try to do what we can to be a resource in the area.
Our guest on The Confluence is Lindsay Gates, Executive Director of the Touchstone Center for Crafts in Farmington, Fayette County. We've been talking a lot about the series, the professional artists that you help. But you have other classes for folks who just, I guess, want to explore their own creativity. Who's your target audience for these more novice classes?
We've started workshops that are shorter in length with the understanding that what used to be our typical length of workshop, 5 days, so Monday through Friday, is not necessarily accommodating to everybody. And it's also quite intimidating as a starting point if you want to try your hand at something new. So we now have two-hour workshops that happen every other Friday evening from June through August, and we call those date nights.
Date nights.
So you don't have to be an official couple, but it's essentially a two-for-one situation where you come for 2 hours. You might learn how to forge a spoon or create a glass pendant or throw your own bowl on a ceramic wheel. And so you leave with a finished product. You've had a chance to visit our campus and also explore your own creativity without too much pressure. And that might lead you into taking a one-day workshop and from there 2 day and on.
All right. Give us the scoop. These date night classes. Do some who attend the date nights encourage their partners, or can it be more about teasing? You made what? What is that supposed to look like?
Well, I'm not going to say that doesn't go on, but I will say that certain couples can get pretty competitive, whether it's siblings that come together, neighbors, or actual couples. It's interesting to see. But what's really great about those evenings is it's really supportive. Overall, they all just have a great time. They have been selling out left and right. And I think the last date night that we had 24 blacksmiths up at our studio.
Wow. Yeah. So competition's a good thing. It can spur you on to get better and better, right?
It is. We find that most people that come and experience a date night start coming back for more.
Arts organizations, they seem to be getting more and more collaborative, whether it's out of necessity or just the efficiency of partnering. Are there any organizations that you do love to work with?
Absolutely. Since I've been out here, it's been wonderful to experience how collaborative of a space the arts space is in Pittsburgh and the surrounding area. Rivers of Steel Arts, we work with them a lot. They come and do iron pours and other metal pours. We also have done some work with Monmade in Pittsburgh, as well as have a few of our workshops that had the opportunity to travel to different Frank Lloyd Wright sites.
Speaking of instructors, do you teach teachers so that they can pass on the skills?
We do. We have a very successful Teen Week. It's the one week of year that we shut down our campus to anybody except teens, and they have immersive programming for 6 solid days on our campus. The chaperones tend to be K through 12 art teachers, and through their feedback, we realized that there was a real need for educators to have a similar week. Mm-hmm. We have started an educators retreat. 2019 was the first year with a lot of success, rave reviews on the networking that happened, on the skills that was learned, and really the resources that became available to these artists and art teachers, as well as we had librarians, Spanish teachers. It really ran the gamut. And what was wonderful is they're all learning, if they're not an art teacher, how to incorporate the arts into their curriculum.
What are you most excited about among your current offerings and maybe what you're hoping to do in the future?
I'm excited to keep partnering with organizations in the area. It's really exciting what can come out of that. Like I said, the mural project, we hosted a symposium with Monmade. There's so much that can be done through partnerships. I'm really looking forward to deepening those connections and seeing where that goes. And always our upcoming season in 2020, we're starting to plan that now and can't reveal too much because everything is in the works. but we will hopefully be bringing some iron pours back, willow basketry, encaustic painting, many different blacksmiths from around the country, and we're just really excited about how the season is shaping up.
Lindsay Gates is Executive Director of Touchstone Center for Crafts in Fayette County. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. A local couple was surprised to pop the hood of their car and find more than 200 walnuts. It turns out squirrels were storing their nuts in their Kia SUV. Their mechanic filled half a trash can with the walnuts. The couple has since gotten a quote on removing a black walnut tree on their property. And a new Pennsylvania law will end the requirement that telephone customers who want to remain on the state's Do Not Call registry have to renew their listing every 5 years. It also bans telemarketing calls on holidays. Find more stories online at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A weathered stone structure sits quietly on the corner of 5th and Belfield Avenues as students, cars, and buses pass nearby. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley explores why the tower seems to be out of place.
Good Question asker Graham Snyder moved to Pittsburgh about a year ago and frequently passes the tower.
I usually commute down 5th Ave, and it suddenly occurred to me that something didn't fit right on that corner. And I wondered, why is there a stone tower by itself in front of a modern building?
Belfield Tower is the last remnant of a church and congregation that once occupied the site. Josh Brown is the pastor of Belfield Presbyterian Church a few blocks away on Thackeray Street. It's confusing, he acknowledges, but there's a story behind the name. His church was originally known as First United Presbyterian, located in downtown Pittsburgh in 1801. When the congregation outgrew that building in the mid-1800s, they moved to Oakland.
And this land that we have, it was deeded to us by Mary Shenley, so this was the Shenley Farms District.
Oakland today is crowded with hospital complexes and skywalks. But in the 19th century, it was farmland. Goats roamed freely as the University of Pittsburgh slowly constructed its iconic buildings. Brown says one section of the neighborhood was called Belfield. Pittsburgh Gazette editor Neville Craig owned land there, and he had multiple family members named Isabel.
And so it became known as Bell's Field.
Around the same time, a Bible study group in the area decided to form its own congregation, and construction began on a new house of worship on the corner of Belfield and Fifth Avenues.
So all that's left of that building is the bell tower now, but that was part of a much larger stone church building that was Belfield Presbyterian Church.
Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation Executive Director Louise Sturgis says the church was designed by architect Frederick J. Osterling.
It was a very beautiful Gothic Revival church, sandstone, red mortar, with Romanesque detailing. And by that I mean, if you look at the capitals of the columns that are still on the tower, you can see them, you'll see carved leaf-like elements.
Osterling also designed downtown's Union Trust Building on Grant Street and the Arup Building on 4th Avenue. His style was popular at the time, and he'd go on to make alterations to the iconic Allegheny County Courthouse. For decades, Belfield Presbyterian and First United coexisted, separated by denominational differences. But in the 1960s, Brown says those denominations merged, and so did the congregations.
They decided that the location at 5th and Thackeray was a better structure, so they moved both of the groups into here, and they said, well, as a kind of a tribute to the other group, you can bring the name Belfield with you.
The newly combined congregation no longer needed the Belfield location. Sturgis says it was eventually sold to the University of Pittsburgh, which wanted to tear it down and build offices.
There was a community uproar, people protested, and so the architects said, we can save the tower.
The bell tower with its red painted door and black wrought iron fasteners remain. Six sandstone steps lead to the front door, which is bolted shut. The bells don't work, but surrounding churches make up for that. Sturgis says part of the original church wall frames a small shaded courtyard.
And it really reminds people, I think, of the value of preserving historic buildings, if only in part. It was a concession to honor people's love of that historic landmark to keep that tower standing.
Meanwhile, Pastor Josh Brown says even though it's been half a century since the two Presbyterian congregations merged, it's still a point of confusion.
Sometimes we get people asking about the history. The thing that we get more often is we are always getting UPS and FedEx drivers who get frustrated because they show up at our door and say, why are you guys Belfield Presbyterian Church if you're on the corner of 5th and Thackeray?
I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Check out more of our good question stories at WESA.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Following last year's grand jury report, the Catholic Church in Pennsylvania began paying reparations to victims of sexual abuse. Seven of the eight dioceses in the state set up compensation programs that offer a lump sum to victims, but also prevent them from suing the church later. Keystone Crossroads' Laura Benshoff reports victims have been wrestling with how to put a price on their trauma.
Growing up in Philadelphia, John Quinn bounced between his family's home and Catholic orphanages all around the city.
Yeah, I ended up in St. John's, St. Joe's, St. Mary's, St. Francis, and St. Michael's in a foster home.
He's now 67 years old. His rough childhood bled into a rough life, which has finally stabilized. He's retired and lives in Arkansas with his fourth wife, who works at a chicken processing plant. They have two teenage sons. When he was their age, he says he was sexually abused by a Catholic priest in Philadelphia.
You know, I get stressed, I get depressed, I get what ifs. What if it didn't happen this way? Where would I be?
Without family to fall back on, he started using drugs to dull the pain. He eventually ran away to New York City and became a sex worker.
And I would make my money and get my drugs and do whatever I had to do.
Quinn is now in long-term recovery for drug and alcohol use. Earlier this year, he applied to the Archdiocese of Philadelphia's Victim Compensation Fund. When they offered him $250,000, he took it in part because he could use the money.
I paid $50,000 in credit card bills first. You know, got my son braces, got my other son a car.
The Archdiocese wouldn't answer questions about Quinn's allegations, but the alleged abuser, who's now deceased, is on their list of credibly accused clergy. Quinn is one of more than 200 people in Pennsylvania who's been paid through victim compensation funds in the past year. Hundreds more have claims pending. All but one Pennsylvania diocese appointed an independent legal expert to vet the claims and make settlement offers. Retired federal judge Lawrence Stengel oversees the Philadelphia Archdiocese program. He says there are no hard and fast rules about how much money someone should get.
Administrators look at the documentation, they look at the nature and extent of the abuse, and they fashion a monetary award.
Stengel says the fact that so many people take what they're offered is a sign of the program's success. So far, dioceses across the Commonwealth have paid out more than $40 million. Critics say the funds themselves aren't independent enough from church leadership, and the amounts they offer are arbitrary. Average payouts from Philadelphia are north of $230,000, while in Scranton and Erie, they're much lower. Donald Asby, a survivor who now lives in central Missouri, was offered around $177,000.
It wasn't enough, and I didn't learn enough about what all really went on.
Asby was an altar boy in Milton, Pennsylvania, when he says two priests with the Diocese of Harrisburg sexually assaulted him. He's now a successful blacksmith and artist. Instead of taking the settlement, Asby decided to sue the church for covering up abuse based on information in the grand jury report. He says the goal of the lawsuit is to make the church pay for its hypocrisy.
You know, the whole idea of being punished, you know, that's the only thing that seems like it's going to make any difference, because so much has been said by the church officials that has turned out to be meaningless, just hot air.
He can afford to wait and see if he'll get the kind of justice he wants through the courts. A spokeswoman for the Diocese of Harrisburg says she can't comment on his allegations due to pending litigation and confirmed that both accused priests are dead. Last week, the compensation programs stopped accepting new claims. Several lawsuits like Asby's are now making their way through PA's courts. For John Quinn, fighting the church is now behind him.
I'm a man of my word. I signed it and said I wasn't going to go after them for anything anymore. The whole thing is draining, very draining, all the time when I got to deal with it.
He says the settlement has helped him be financially comfortable, and he's trying to look ahead. Some of the money is going to a small town in Veracruz, Mexico, where his wife is from.
Did I tell you I built a house in Mexico?
He pulls out his phone and shows a picture of a brightly painted stucco building.
It's almost finished.
Oh, I love the purple.
That's my favorite color.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
His wife has been sending money home for years, and soon they'll be able to finally enjoy the house they've built. Laura Benshoff, Keystone Crossroads.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pirates go on a horrible losing skid, playing themselves right out of contention. The Steelers lose quarterback Ben Roethlisberger 5 quarters into the season for the rest of the year. The Penguins lose star center Evgeny Malkin for an extended time in game 2 of the season. Pittsburgh sports fans are wondering, what's going on? Rob Rossi and his colleagues at The Athletic, Rob Beertemple and Mark Caboli, have traced the string of disappointments, misadventures, over the course of a year. Rob is on the road with the Penguins and joins us now. Hey, Rob.
Hey, yeah, we wanted to thoroughly depress people going into the holiday season, so that's why we put that together.
So did Pittsburgh sports teams as a group walk under a ladder or break a giant mirror?
You know, it's funny, when I was talking to the Penguins general manager, Jim Rutherford, when they confirmed about Malkin's length of, you know, longer term injury, I said, have you ever seen anything like this? He goes, there's got to be something in the air here, right? I've never seen any city go through this. I mean, I think, you know, maybe to preface this, Kevin, we should say that Pittsburgh's been really lucky. You know, it's been since 2003, since all of the Pittsburgh teams weren't in the playoffs, or at least one of the teams wasn't in the playoffs. So we've had a lot of success and a pretty good run of it. Yeah, this is unprecedented. The Penguins, the Pirates, and the Steelers all going through tumultuous times at the same moment is not something that has really happened in Pittsburgh since the early 1980s.
You traced this trend back to last November when Steelers running back Le'Veon Bell decided to sit out the entire season, a season, I might add, where the Steelers missed the playoffs. Why is that the spark that set off our collective dumpster fire?
You know, I asked Mark Caboli about that, and he said that's sort of the first thing we didn't see coming. And, you know, I think what he means by that is, you know, it's easy to look back now and remember it with sort of revisionist history. But at the time, the idea of a player not getting paid by his own decision and sitting out a season was unthinkable. So that sort of started the fall for the Steelers. And really, it just, the ball kind of kept rolling from there. The Penguins sort of went into a midseason funk, and, you know, they ended up being swept in the playoffs. The Pirates had a nice start to their season, but, I mean, they had one of the worst second halves in the 120-plus year history of the franchise. So, hey, at least Pitt's uniforms look nice.
Well, we don't have time to talk about the entire year of woes, but you list them chronologically with a summary of what happened, and we'll have a link to that piece on our website. You could have done most of your entire story on the drama of then Steeler wide receiver Antonio Brown. There were tantrums, demands, finally a trade. But do you think the Antonio Brown saga actually turned out as good as it could have for the Steelers, considering what happened since he was traded to Oakland and then on to New England?
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, they don't actually have to deal with all of his antics. And look, I was around the Steelers a good bit last year, Kevin. The Antonio Brown situation was as chaotic as any I've ever been a part of. And it ended up being really difficult, I think, for that team to sustain any type of momentum because he just kept making it about himself.
Our guest on The Confluence is Rob Rossi, who, along with his colleagues at The Athletic, Rob Beertemple and Mark Caboli, have traced, shall we say, a string of misadventures for Pittsburgh professional sports teams since November of last year. Rob, we were talking a little bit about the Penguins. Some of the Penguins' slip-ups appear prominently in your story, going back as far as the middle of last season. How did what happened with Geno Malkin at the end of last season and the beginning of this one sort of factor into the team we're looking at today?
Well, Evgeny had a really bad year last year in a lot of ways, and I'm not talking about just on the ice, although on the ice he played well below his standard. Now, for 95% of the players in the league, Evgeny's year last year would have been a raving success, but he's held to a higher standard, obviously, as a you know, future Hall of Fame player. And, you know, for him to perform the way he did wasn't acceptable to his standard. But also, by his own admission, got into a lot of, you know, quote-unquote fights. I would describe them as sort of arguments with a coach about playing time. He was not happy about Phil Kessel. He likes Phil. He considers him a friend, but that doesn't mean he thought them playing together on the same line was feasible anymore. He didn't think that was the case and didn't think it could work going forward. And, you know, also, Evgeny's got a young son and he's married, and, you know, his wife is a Russian television journalist. She spent some time during the holidays last year in Moscow. Her and their son, spent some time at their home in Miami when the weather was pretty dreary here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, I think Evgeny missed his family.
Well, you mentioned Phil Kessel, new faces. Of course, Kessel was traded during the offseason along with Olli Maatta. Anyone that gives you hope for the rest of 2019, maybe from those new faces?
Yeah, you know, boy, maybe I should lie and say yes. you know, I think Alex Galchenyuk, the player they acquired for Phil Kessel, is a really nice player, and I think he was going to fit in very well here, but he was going to be the left winger on Malkin's line, and, you know, Malkin's probably going to miss at least 6 weeks with this leg injury, so it's, you know, it's going to be tougher on Galchenyuk, who's, you know, very much a guy that, you know, he's a great goal scoring talent, but, you know, I think the Penguins like the idea of him playing with a great center, and Sidney Crosby already has a left winger, and Jake Guentzel scored 40 goals last year, so this may be too inside hockey, but as of early this week, the Penguins, you know, they have a 23-man roster, and 11 players have played 40 or fewer games with them. Ooh. So that tells you what they're dealing with. A lot of inexperience, at least as it exists with the Penguins culture. And I think that's the one thing to remember. As bad as it might be in Pittsburgh right now, we're not too far removed from back-to-back Stanley Cup titles.
Yeah, my T-shirts haven't faded from washing them yet from those championship years. So, Rob, of course, the Buccos. I think it's fair to say hopes haven't been high for some time. But there are a lot more question marks since they fell down an elevator shaft after the All-Star break. But it wasn't just the losing, was it? I mean, the scuffles in the locker room, the charges against Felipe Vasquez at the end of the season, attendance technically listed at about 9,000, but you could barely see 100 faces in the stands at one game. And now Clint Hurdle's gone.
You know, look, we absolve them of anything with the Vasquez situation, because, you know, nobody can see that coming, right? So let's be clear, and that's way outside the realm of sports. But firing Clint Hurdle looked bad, because Hurdle had told our Stephen Nesbitt that he had been told he would be back, and then they reversed course on that. They fired him on the last day of the year on Steve Blass's final broadcast. I mean, that was just mismanagement in terms of public relations, and, you know, they completely bottomed out. And you looked at games this year, and there didn't look like there was anybody there. And, you know, that's a concern for this reason. Part of the Pirates' plan is to make the game day experience at PNC Park so enjoyable that the results don't matter. And to a large extent, I think they've succeeded in that. But you can't give the impression in a city like Pittsburgh, where the football team has, you know, had a 50-year run of mostly glorious success and competitiveness, and the hockey team has won the championship 5 times in the last quarter century. You can't give the impression, if you're the Pirates, that you're not trying to win.
So Pirates go on the horrible losing skid. At that point, sports fans might be saying, okay, we got the Steelers, and then Ben Roethlisberger injures his elbow, he's out for the season. Then sports fans say, okay, Penguins are back, and in game two, Geno Malkin gets hurt. And was that the straw that broke sports fans' backs?
Yeah, I think the Malkin injury was sort of like everybody just going, okay, like, who did we anger? Like, what did we do? You're talking about two generationally iconic stars that were counted on this year to be big reasons the teams rebounded, right? The Steelers missed the playoffs, and they lost Le'Veon Bell. They lost Antonio Brown. Ben was the last of the killer bees left. And, you know, he's the Super Bowl quarterback, the franchise player. You know, this was supposed to be his year where he was, you know, maybe going to be an MVP candidate because his play would elevate a younger team, right? And with Malkin, a lot of the same thing. It was the Penguins had gone through a lot of changes after being swept in the playoffs. There's a lot of talk that he might have an MVP-type year because he might carry them. And now their NHL best 13-year playoff streak appears to be in jeopardy because, you know, Malkin might not be back until late November.
So, Rob, for all three of the sports teams, were some of these woes a bigger stir for the fans than they were for the locker rooms of the teams?
Yes, and I think generally it's something to keep in mind is these guys are professionals. Their job is to almost tune out the distractions so that they can go about their business of coming to practice every day or coming to a game and you know, being professionals like any of us would at work or home or whatever, right? So I think a lot of this stuff, they don't think about it. I mean, if you, as I have, ask, you know, Sidney Crosby of getting Malkin's injury, he talks about what he needs to do to make sure that it doesn't become a problem for the Penguins. And, you know, I'm sure the Steeler players are saying the same thing about Ben Roethlisberger. But fans don't think that way, right? Fans think about the teams as sort of representing the city. You know, I think this is more of a collective thread for the respective Steeler Nation and Penguin Nation and maybe Pirate County. I'm not sure they get it. Hey, look, you're the one that said there were about like 9,000 people at the game. So, but I think it's more of a collective thread for the fans than it is the teams. Because if the teams start worrying about that stuff, then they're going to have less success than they're having at the moment.
So, Rob, who do we root for? Maybe Pitt Volleyball? They're ranked number three in the nation after all.
Yes, definitely support the college teams that don't bring in the revenue. I would say that no matter what, because those athletes don't often get the accolades. But look, the Penguins could still make the playoffs, and the Steelers division is an abomination. They're only a game and a half out of first place, despite having only one win. So, you know, as bad as things are, keep this in mind. The Steelers are 1-4, and they have a shot, and the Penguins still have Sidney Crosby, which is more than most teams have. As for the Pirates, spring training is where things are always eternally optimistic. So maybe just bide your time till February. And by then it'll be a new year, Kevin, so all things will be looking up.
Rob Rossi and his colleagues Mark Caboli and Rob Beer Temple at The Athletic have written Inside the Year from Hell for Pittsburgh sports teams. Rob, thanks so much for joining us, I think.
Hey, we're still standing, so let's knock on wood, I guess.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On November 5th, voters across Pennsylvania will face a ballot question that would amend the state's constitution. Or will they? With just a bit more than 3 weeks to go to Election Day, a suit has been filed to strike the question from the ballot. Joining us from Harrisburg is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning.
Katie, before we get to the reasons for the legal challenge, please remind us briefly what the amendment would do. It's known as Marcy's Law.
Marcy's Law, yes. So it would essentially put an existing, quote-unquote, Bill of Rights for victims, for crime victims, into the Pennsylvania Constitution. So the goal is to make sure that victims, or to create a situation in which victims sort of have the same level of rights and recourse as the accused in these cases. So, for instance, if a victim wanted to testify or speak at a hearing and they weren't permitted to or weren't notified of the hearing, they could ask the court for a new one. Mm-hmm. So it would just give them a little bit more recourse, as it's written, to make sure they're heard at trial.
Right. The House and Senate easily passed this measure in two consecutive sessions, as is required for a constitutional amendment to go to voters. But the ACLU has opposed it. How do they say it might compromise the rights of the accused?
So there's a couple ways. They say it's too vague, maybe too broad. They're not sure how it's going to be used. They say, you know, the accused, the weight of the state in these cases, it's against them. You know, there's a reason why we protect people's rights when they're accused of crimes. And so they have the right to, a speedy trial, for instance. The ACLU is worried that this could slow down trials, elongate things. The Marcy's Law backers say it won't do that. It really just gives victims more recourse in, you know, under what the Crime Victims Act already does. So that's the tension there. Mm-hmm.
The ACLU filed suit in Commonwealth Court on behalf of the League of Women Voters and an individual plaintiff. Briefly, what's the argument for removing it from the ballot?
So it's not related to the issues they've had with it in the past. Now they're arguing the amendment is too broad. So the Constitution says that if you want to submit, you know, two or more amendments, you have to have them be voted on by voters separately in the referendums. And so they're saying this contains more than one change to the Constitution. They're saying it contains 9 or so. Mm. And it only changes the language in one section, but they're saying those changes actually affect how other sections are going to be interpreted. So they're saying if you wanted to make this changes to of this level, you either had to pass a bunch of different amendments or you have to go to a constitutional convention, which allows for bigger changes.
Katie, we have just a minute left. What did supporters of Marcy's Law tell you in reaction?
Well, yeah, they said that this was baseless. They think that it's just one change. They don't think the ACLU has a good case. Of course, that's what you always get in cases like this. So we will have to see what the judge, what the courts do. The ACLU asked for an expedited opinion, so we might get that relatively soon. We'll have to see.
In a sentence or so, if it is stricken by the court, what happens to the counties that already have prepared their ballots? Again, we're just 3 weeks away.
Yeah, it's kind of unclear. I think perhaps, you know, if people have already submitted absentee ballots, for instance, those just wouldn't be counted. Perhaps, you know, it would just could be considered null and void no matter how people vote. So this doesn't happen super regularly, so we'll really have to see.
All right. Katie Meyer, WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief. We'll look forward to your continued reporting on the topic. Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Quill Lawrence was NPR's Baghdad bureau chief and reported for years on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now he's the network's full-time veterans correspondent, exploring the residual effects on those who fought in those wars. A conversation with Quill Lawrence ahead of his trip to Pittsburgh. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.